foreseeable future. For that matter, Agent Hoover and his people have no way to return home, and little more they can do for us here. Is there a liability now, Lemmy?
Garone inhaled deeply. He listened to virtually every piece of advice Delacorte had given him, but he was uncertain about this one. He understood her concern, of course, but killing Confederation personnel seemed dangerous. Hell, it was dangerous. Beru would need the Confederation again someday. Delacorte was right that there was little more they could expect from the Confeds in the immediate future, but Beru could never survive for the long term without some aid from the Confederation, perhaps even some pressure on the Union government to accept a negotiated resolution.
We can't, Amy. I understand your concern, but it's not just Hoover.
One death could possibly be explained away, but if they moved against the Confeds, they'd have to kill them all.
He's got a whole group with them, other agents and all the experts who helped retool the factories, not to mention the crew of the last supply ship who couldn't get away. You're talking about killing dozens of people, and eventually explaining their deaths to the Confederation. Without Confederation help and recognition, we've got no chance the Union will ever recognize our independence.
She slid closer to him on the bed, moving her lips close to his ear.
It's true, my love, that we can't seem to be responsible for their deaths. But what if they were killed by a splinter group, by that rodent Bernard and his rabble? Perhaps they're even under the influence of Union agents, or better still, what if Bernard and his people are Sector 9, agents left behind to infiltrate and destroy the revolution? We might even report those deaths to the Confederation if we're ever able to get a message through. Such an outrageous atrocity by Union agents might even provoke a renewal of hostilities between the two powers. What could serve our needs more than that?
Garone listened to everything she said, and as he did, a new thought materialized, one he found unsettling. Amy Delacorte was insane. He quivered with pleasure as she moved even closer, pressing her lips against his neck. Rationality slipped from his mind, replaced only by desire. He'd never been able to resist her, and this moment proved no different. Still, the more he thought about it, the more he was certain she was crazy. He just didn't care.
Chapter 18. Confederation Intelligence Headquarters, Port Royal City, Planet Danith, Ventica 3, 315 AC.
Mr. Holston, Colonel Peterson is here to see you, sir.
The aide stood by the door, poking his head inside the small office. Confederation Intelligence's headquarters in Port Royal City was an underwhelming facility, small, cramped, and lacking modern equipment. Holston had realized all of this shortly after he made the office his command center, and he immediately understood one reason at least that Sector 9 had kicked his tail for so long in pursuit of old tech. He also realized it was his fault, at least on some level. He was the head of Confederation Intelligence. He'd always known he needed to pour greater resources into Danith and the other border planets, but there had always been another crisis, a problem with a higher priority, and then there was the war.
Show him in.
Holston didn't address the aide personally, mostly because he'd forgotten the man's name. He wasn't part of the team Holston had brought, just some career intelligence hack who'd been mediocre enough to get posted to the tiny, ineffective office.
Mr. Holston, it's good to see you again.
Peterson walked into the room almost immediately. Clearly, he'd been standing right behind the aide. The Marine was a big man, nearly 2 full meters and muscular to match. His steel gray hair was neatly clipped, and a massive cigar hung out from the side of his mouth.
It's good to see you too, Colonel. I wish the circumstances were more cheerful.
My people don't get called very often when the circumstances are cheerful.
Peterson reached up and pulled the cigar from his mouth. Technically, there was no smoking allowed in the office, but Holston didn't really care. And by all appearances, Peterson didn't give a shit either.
So tell me, can we drop the Mr. Holston, Colonel Peterson shit, or are we performing for our people here?
No, John, there's no need for formality.
Holston almost overcame his grim mood and laughed. Almost.
All right, Gary, then tell me what you called me here for. And for God's sake, let me know what you need with a division of crack Marines on a Confederation planet in peacetime.
Peterson dragged out one of the chairs facing Holston's desk, and he sat down, dropping his bull card into the seat.
I've got an operative missing, John, and I intend to find her.
if I've got to tear apart every building on Danith to do it.
Well, I saw the Naval Task Force in orbit, and you've quarantined the entire planet. So I'm guessing this isn't just any agent.
Holston sighed. No, John, she's not. She's a friend. And she's very close to another friend, but that's not it, not really. She's wealthy. She was retired from a difficult and dangerous career, and the Confederation owes her a debt, one few people will ever know about. She only came back here because I asked her to, and she'd barely gotten started when she got snatched under my nose.
So you feel responsible, like you sucked her in and failed her.
Holston wasn't very sensitive most of the time, but Peterson's words made him wince. The Marine had a reputation for cutting the crap and getting right to the point. A well-deserved reputation.
Yes, I feel responsible, mostly because I am responsible. Okay, Gary, let's forget for a minute that whoever this is, it sounds like she was experienced, tough, hardcore in her own right. Am I far from the mark?
Holston shook his head.
All right, so she might have come back because you asked her, but I'll bet she was perfectly capable of making her own decisions. Still, I know none of that matters. You're gonna blame yourself, and I understand that.
The Marine paused.
So let's talk about the real problem. You've got the statutory authority to shut down ingress and egress from a planet. At least it's a gray area, and you've got a good case to claim you do. You've even got the power to order my division here and put us to work bashing down the doors of Confederation citizens. But it's all subject to review, my old friend, and I know you know it won't be long before you're called before a Senate committee to justify your actions. I've been blissfully removed from the fetid swamp of politics most of my life, but I know enough about it to guess that a lot of the gas bags on that committee are not going to agree that a lost agent was sufficient justification for what you're doing.
He paused again.
You're putting yourself on the line here, old friend. You've got to realize that.
Peterson's voice was soft, sincere.
Yes, John, I realize that. But no more on the line than Andy put herself. Getting blasted by a bunch of politicians doesn't seem like much compared to being tortured or killed. Hell, if they want to fire me, let them fire me. Who the hell else would want this damn job anyway?
You've got a lot of enemies in the capital, don't forget that. You've run roughshod over them more than once. Holston was about to argue when Peterson raised his hand.
Don't worry, I know you only did what had to be done. Odds are we'd be fighting Foudre Rouge on the streets of Megara if you hadn't, but that doesn't change the fact that there are resentful politicians there, powerful ones. They may try to do more than fire you, and they'll have crowds of angry citizens and business owners on Danith screaming about what you did, demanding restitution for their losses.
You think after all I've seen I'm scared of a bunch of senators trying to put me in prison? They're welcome to try. I've got so much foul dirt on half of them. If they want to start a war with me, they're going to find us very two-sided.
That may be, Gary, but the fact is, a lot of these guys know how to play dirty. You may be the master, but don't underestimate the political enemies you've got.
I don't, John. I know this is risky, but I just can't abandon Andy. She's here because of me, and whatever it takes, whatever the risk to me, I've got to get her out. The big Marine nodded.
All right, that's enough for me. I just hope my helping you doesn't end with you on some prison planet a year from now.
Let's hope. If I am, I can guarantee you I won't be alone.
So much for caution and are you sures. I knew you wouldn't listen to my warning, so I've got one of my regiments on the way down already. I just hope people don't see the landers coming in and panic. I'm afraid it probably looks a lot like an invasion.
That's a chance we'll have to take. It's bad enough whoever's got Andy might see those landers, too. I'm damn sure not going to make any public announcements until we've got your people in place.
I understand. Peterson nodded. So where do you want my people, Gary? What are the top priorities?
Minister Lié, I'm sorry to interrupt.
Lié glanced back quickly toward the aide, almost correcting the woman's nomenclature again, but then deciding it was pointless. He understood Villeneuve's purposes in instituting the new system, but just calling everyone citizen wasn't very useful in most situations. His people were all Sector 9 veterans, agents who were clever enough or who'd maintained a low enough profile to escape the bloodletting that had cleared the way for Gaston Villeneuve to become the hero of the revolution. They were good, all of them, but they were also used to a hierarchical system, and he was accustomed to being close to the top of such a pyramid.
Yes, what is it?
His impatience was clear in his tone. It wasn't directed at the operative, though he doubted she'd come with good news. Andy Lafarge was proving much harder to break than he'd expected.
He'd held back from the harshest treatments, anything that would cause permanent damage. Lafarge had spent her life as an outlaw in the eyes of the Confederation, and in his view, she had no cause to exhibit loyalty to a government that had condemned and hassled her all her life. He'd allowed himself to hope he could win her over eventually, convince her to join forces with him, and to reap the true benefits of her extraordinary and unorthodox skill set. She was stubborn. He'd known that much going in, but she was a survivor, too. She had to know the only way she was going to get out alive was to agree to work with him. He'd heard rumors that she'd had an extraordinary windfall, one which had made her breathtakingly wealthy, and consequently immune to bribery. But if those whispers were true, what the hell was she doing on Danith, poking around the seedy adventurers' bars that dotted the promenade?
So?
The aide had hesitated, clearly aware that he was distracted. Go on. He turned and looked toward the agent, still only half paying attention.
We have confirmed that Danith is under quarantine. All ship traffic, both in and out, has been halted. The spaceports are closed down, and we have multiple sources confirming that a naval squadron is in position around the planet.
Ricard's distraction slipped away. He'd heard several reports of the sort the aide was giving him, but none of them had been confirmed until now. But the Confeds had closed down Danith, and that was a problem. First, it meant he was trapped there. He might have made a run past a quarantine order, but if the Confed Navy was up there enforcing it, that pretty much removed that option. Perhaps the more dangerous question was, why had they taken such action? It couldn't be just because he'd grabbed Lafarge. He knew she'd had some interactions with the Navy in recent years, and that she'd had a sporadic dalliance with Tyler Baron, but he hadn't considered any serious implications. Could that be it? Is she closer to Baron than I thought? He shook his head. Any serious connection between Baron and Lafarge changed things dramatically. If she was truly involved with the Admiral, his chances of winning her over to his side were far less than he'd hoped. It might mean that Lafarge was truly committed to Confederation intelligence, and his plan would have to change. If he couldn't win her over, he'd have to find out everything she knew, and her true purpose on Danith. He wasn't ready to give up on her entirely, not yet at least, but he was far closer to doing so than he'd been a few minutes ago. The loss of Lafarge as a potential asset would hurt his plans. She'd have been invaluable as one of his operatives, but giving up on recruiting her would have its advantages. He could focus entirely on getting information out of her, and he could use more aggressive means to extract what he needed. He'd no longer have to be concerned about causing permanent damage, especially since he'd be putting a pair of bullets in her head when he was done with her anyway.
Chapter 19. CFS Repulse. Z-11 System. Year 315 AC.
Yes, Commodore. I had three separate reports, each from a different team. Every section of debris they've searched is completely cleaned out. All the equipment, or what was left of it, removed. Nothing but the main structures remaining. I thought that was something you needed to know as soon as possible.
Removed? Are they certain? Eaton sat in the center of Repulse's bridge, the huge space suddenly devoid of the normal chatter and background noise. If she'd known what Stockton was going to report, she'd have had him piped directly to her headset instead of broadcasting on the main speakers.
That was my perception, Commodore. We didn't discuss it at length, but all three groups reported similar findings.
Very well, Captain. Eden sat for a few seconds, silent. The truth was she didn't know what to say or what to do. The news was unsettling, but far from conclusive. Was it possible some border adventurers had made it out this far sometime over the last century?
It seemed unlikely. Impossible, she'd almost call it. Yet that would explain Stockton's report, in a far less unsettling manner than anything else bouncing around in her head.
He made the right decision to expedite the report, Captain Stockton, she added abruptly. Repulse should reestablish communications with the teams in 10 minutes. As soon as we're in position, land your fighters and send out fresh ones. I want the orbital areas patrolled constantly, Captain.
Understood, Commodore. I'll see to it. Stockton out.
Eden leaned back in her chair. She could feel every eye on the bridge boring into her. Her people had been on edge, if not since the mission began, certainly since the fleet had discovered the first active scanning device. Individual tolerances varied for feeling far from home, lost in the endless dark. But by now, pretty much everyone in the fleet was dealing with a heavy dose of stress. Stockton's report only made that worse.
All right, I want all stations ready. As soon as we come about, we're launching shuttles to retrieve the teams. I want them brought aboard Repulse for debriefing at once. And I want twice as many fresh teams sent out. We're going to examine every piece of orbital debris out there, one at a time, and we're going to see if they're all in the same condition.
Yes, Commodore. Her order spurred some activity, a bit of chatter going back and forth between stations. But the activity level was subdued, her people still distracted by what they'd heard.
That wasn't a request, people, she said, her voice stern and loud. We've got shuttles to prepare and exploration teams to get ready and not much time. Move it.
The bridge erupted into a nervous beehive of activity, half a dozen voices suddenly speaking into comm units, and most of the other officers busy at their workstations. That was good. Better for them to be thinking about work than wondering who, or what, had taken the equipment from those space station segments.
Bay Command report shuttles will be ready to launch in 16 minutes, Commodore.
No, she said coldly. I want them ready in 10 minutes.
Yes, Commodore.
She listened as the officer repeated the order. She suspected whoever was on duty in launch control was arguing that 10 minutes wasn't enough time, but she didn't care. Her people were good, but there wasn't a doubt in her mind that their performance had slipped a notch since the war. Nothing matched the threat of impending death and destruction to inspire the best possible performance. At least nothing but a Commodore and hardcore combat veteran breathing down their necks. Eden didn't let herself get carried away with her thoughts, imagining there was any combat imminent or anything like that. But she'd been edgy since the fleet left Confederation space, and now she was as tense as she'd been since the ceasefire had ended combat and sent her ships back to friendly territory.
Launch control acknowledges, Commodore. Shuttles will be ready in 10 minutes.
Very well. Eden nodded, feeling a touch of satisfaction, and wondering if the new exploration teams would be ready and mounted up as quickly as the shuttles themselves. She glanced at the main display, watching as the oval that represented Repulse moved slowly around the large sphere of the planet. Then she stood up abruptly.
I'll be in my office. Report anything at all out of the ordinary to me immediately.
Yes, Commodore. She took a few steps toward the back of the bridge, to the small corridor that led to her private office. She had to report this to Tyler Barron, and the sooner the better. Dauntless was still a good 15 light seconds away, which made a two-sided communication possible, if frustrating. She wasn't sure how Barron would react or what orders he might give her, but she was damn sure she wanted to have that conversation in private. She stopped just outside the hallway and turned back.
And bring Captain Stockton to me the instant he lands.
Yes, Commodore. She hesitated for a few seconds, and then she walked down the corridor and into her office. The shuttle shook hard, skipping off the atmosphere as it continued its descent from orbit. The planet's air was a bit heavier than Megara's, and that made for a rougher ride and a tougher workout for the heat shields. Brian Rogan had seen worse, of course. Serving 7 years under Tyler Barron had been many things, but one thing they hadn't been was quiet. Rogan still had nightmares from the battle his Marines had fought with Alliance stormtroopers on Santis. That had been a small engagement, insignificant perhaps by historical standards, but it was a near certainty that no one who'd fought there would ever forget any of it. Rogan had worn a captain's insignia then, and his command had consisted of approximately 200 men and women, Dauntless's Marine contingent, plus a few survivors from the Santis garrison. Now a pair of stars sat in the place those captain's bars had occupied, and the two companies he commanded had grown to a reinforced brigade of over 4,000 Marines, every one of them a veteran from the Union War. Rogan had been based on the new Dauntless. No one who'd served on the first ship to bear that name could think of the massive new battleship of anything other than the new or second one. But he transferred temporarily to Repulse when Commodore Eaton took her force to the advanced guard position. He hadn't particularly expected his Marines to be needed for anything beyond routine duty guarding the landing party camps on any planets worth exploring. But now he wasn't so sure. He'd heard enough of the reports from the orbital search parties to reignite his Marines' suspicion. He didn't know if the search teams would run into old tech systems that were still operational, or some kind of rogue adventurers farther out than anyone had imagined possible. But he was damn sure of one thing. It was his job to make sure everyone Eaton or Barron sent down was protected. And Brian Rogan took his job very seriously. He shifted in his seat, feeling every minute of the year or more since he'd been fully armored for battle. It was probably overkill. From the complaints he'd heard from his Marines, they clearly thought it was. But he wasn't taking chances. His people would be the first ones out of the shuttles, and they would be setting foot on a world vastly distant from home, from anything familiar. Rogan wasn't taking chances.
We'll be down in 3 minutes, General.
Rogan nodded, though he realized, of course, the pilot up in the cockpit couldn't see him.
Acknowledged, he finally said. He sucked in a deep breath immediately after, doing what he could to hold back the nausea. Rogan had done his share of combat landings, but he'd never gotten quite completely used to the stomach-churning aspects of the whole enterprise. He flipped on his comm unit, activating the main channel.
All right, Marines, we'll be on the ground in a few minutes. I want everybody sharp. You know the procedures, and I don't want to see any sloppiness just because there aren't any Foudre Rouge out there waiting to blow your brains out. Every one of you knows where you're supposed to be, so stay sharp and get it done.
Rogan felt a small grin forming on his face. He had about 70 Marines with the landing group, 2 platoons. He remembered his days as a young Marine and how nervous it would have made him to have a general in direct command of the force. Rogan knew he probably should have delegated the duty to one of his junior officers, but rank did have its privileges, after all. And after almost 2 years of quiet, routine post-war duty, he wasn't about to miss out on the first landing on an ancient imperial world.
Keep your eyes open and report anything that seems strange, even if it's just a tightness in your gut you think is this morning's breakfast. No one is to take any chances.
He paused, then added, and keep those breathers on until you get orders to the contrary. The probes had confirmed the atmosphere was breathable, and preliminary scans hadn't detected any unusual pathogens. That made sense, since it appeared that millions of people had once lived on the planet. Still, Commodore Eaton had ordered full precautions to be taken until the ground teams could confirm the drone's analysis. He reached down and grabbed the mask hanging down at his side, strapping it across his head and tucking the strap under the back of his helmet. He tapped the small switch on his side, and he felt the cool, oxygen-heavy air begin to flow. There was an immediate rush, a burst of energy and awareness as the oxygen-heavy gas filled his lungs. His eyes darted around the cabin, noting every detail as the 19 other Marines present more or less copied his actions. He looked up at the main screen, less than 30 seconds to landing. His stomach tightened, his whole body tensing up. This mission would likely be nothing more than routine security for the landing parties, but his combat reflexes had been hardwired by all the action he'd seen, and his instincts reacted as they would for a combat drop. He reached around for the assault rifle he realized wasn't there. He had a sidearm, but he'd advanced well into the ranks that rarely carried weapons heavier than pistols, especially when it wasn't a combat assault. Still, his reflexes remembered his earlier days, and his hands felt empty without the feel of his old Mark IX rifle. The shuttle shook as the landing thrusters fired and lowered the ship gently, fairly gently at least, onto the ground. We're here, on a planet no one has visited since the Cataclysm. He felt exhilarated. And nervous, too. This was something new.
Let's go!
He roared, slapping his hands down on the harness release and jumping to his feet the instant the ready light turned green. Even as he turned toward the rear of the shuttle, the back ramp began to open, dropping hard into place. He raced toward the opening, his eyes catching the rays of sunlight pouring in, reflecting off the metal of the ramp. He knew a general should wait, allow his Marines to exit first and secure the area, but Rogan hadn't led from behind when he'd been heading toward thousands of Foudre Rouge, dug in and supported by heavy weapons. He wasn't about to hang back and hide behind his Marines on a dead and empty world. Besides, his curiosity was almost overpowering. He was about to see something humanity hadn't seen for centuries. He ran out into the bright sunshine, feeling the gentle warmth of the day, an almost perfect temperature. There was a light breeze, and above he gazed at a bright blue sky with just a few puffy white clouds. It was as pleasant a sight as he'd seen on Megara, or any other world of the Confederation. But the euphoria didn't last. He turned his head and looked off to the north. The shuttle had landed on a large rise overlooking a long valley, and he froze as he saw it. A city, one of the probes had located from the air, a vast metropolis that stretched almost as far as the eye could see. And one that was nothing but shattered remains of steel girders covered with overgrown rubble. He'd known it was there, of course. He'd come looking for it. And yet he was stunned at the actual sight of the thing. There were a few shadowy structures, low buildings that had at least partially survived whatever had destroyed the city. But most of what he saw was rubble, fields of debris extending to the horizon. Shattered masonry and twisted girders of steel, melted and reformed, protruded from the ground at all angles. He'd been to Troia City, the Confederation's capital, a dozen times, and each time he'd walked away amazed at the magnificence of what his people had built. but Troyes was scarcely a rural village compared to what this immense metropolis had been. Rogan tried to imagine the magnificent skyline of vast buildings that had once stood there, but nothing now reached more than 10 or 20 meters from the tortured ground. All around, plant growth had encroached on what had once been humanity's domain, and even in the dead city's center, vines climbed and twisted all around the blackened skeletal remains of buildings. He turned and glanced back at his people. The Marines from his own shuttle had formed a rough circle around the craft, their weapons drawn and ready, but their eyes all focused on the remains of the ancient city. The scientists and others on the shuttle were coming out now, moving up behind the Marines. They were just as mesmerized by the sight laying before them. Half a dozen shuttles were down now, their passengers beginning to stream out as the other ships of the expedition continued to land. Rogan pulled his attention away from the city, checking on the Marine contingents deploying all around the hill. "Let's go, Marines," he snapped into his comm. "This city is interesting, but you've all got jobs to do, so let's get to it." He turned back and walked toward a trio of technicians who were setting up a portable comm station. "Status? We'll have it up and running in a minute, sir." Rogan nodded. As soon as the station was working, he had to report back to Commodore Eaton. Rogan had no problem commanding the Marine detachment and handling security for the landing parties, but for reasons that escaped him, Eaton had put him in command of the entire expedition. It wasn't unreasonable, considering his rank, but he couldn't help but feel he had no place ordering the scientists and engineers around, not to mention archaeologists, medical teams, and a dozen other types of experts. The med team had set up their equipment right next to the comm station, and they were already running their tests. Once they gave the clearance, he could issue the go-ahead to ditch the breathing gear, which would make everyone a lot more comfortable. "We should have a direct line on Repulse in another 90 seconds, sir." "Very well." Rogan took a deep breath, feeling almost lightheaded for a second from the oxygen-rich mixture he was inhaling. He watched as the comm technicians finished their setup, and then he waited for Repulse to come around in its orbit far enough to establish a connection. He'd counted down to 24 when he heard it.
"General Rogan!"
The voice was wild, out of control, thick with every emotion from excitement to stark terror.
"What is it?"
He spun around, pulling out a small tablet and pulling up a location on the collar.
"Sir, you need to get here, now!"
He turned his head, looking off to the southwest. The lieutenant on the comm was about 60 meters from his current location, hidden right now by the crest of the hill. He jogged over toward the designated location, and as he did, he saw a crowd forming, Marines and technicians alike standing in a rough line, all of them focused on... Rogan stopped, frozen, his eyes fixed on a small cluster of... people? They were very short, and they seemed to be hunched over. Long brown hair hung down from their heads. Then Rogan realized they weren't as short as he'd thought at first. They were bent over. No. They were on their knees, right before the cluster of Marines at the front of the growing crowd. My God. People. Rogan swallowed hard, still trying to convince himself he wasn't hallucinating. They had come looking for old tech. But they had found... is it even possible? Could they really be descendants from survivors of the cataclysm? Chapter 20. Hall of the People, Liberté City, Planet Montmorel, Gassara 4, Union Year 219, 315 AC.
"I want to thank you again for accepting our invitation. It's an honor and a pleasure to host our neighbors as friends."
Villeneuve stood in the vast reception room, smiling at the half-dozen emissaries from the Collective. The cavernous chamber was one of the few of such magnificence to survive the orgy of destruction that had accompanied the Revolution and Villeneuve's march back to power. He was clad as he always was in public in a factory worker's drab garb, but he donned a fresh set for the occasion, new and clean and devoid of the tears and stains that scarred so many of the outfits he'd worn since the Revolution.
"We are equally honored, Minister Villeneuve."
The ambassador, dressed in significantly more opulent formal attire, paused.
"Though I must say that we were somewhat surprised at the invitation."
Villeneuve maintained a smile. He understood the diplomat's hesitation and the meaning behind the man's restrained words. The Union had bullied its weaker neighbors, imposing harsh trade terms on them or conquering them outright. The Collective was the largest and strongest of the remaining entities, with about 30 inhabited worlds. Though habitation along the periphery tended to be modest, and the Collective's capital world had fewer than 200 million inhabitants,
That was minuscule by comparison with Union planets like Mont Morao.
Mr. Ambassador, I can only apologize profusely and with all sincerity for the actions of the old government. The Union was founded with the purest of intentions, but I fear it fell from its path long ago and, I dare say, became a bully in international relations. I can assure you, the People's Union will in no way follow in the footsteps of its predecessor. We seek only harmony with peaceful neighbors and the strength to resist those who would threaten us.
A pause, then. And I'm just Citizen Villeneuve, Your Excellency. We've dispensed with the structure and titles of elitism in the new union.
The ambassador had an uncertain look on his face. It was no secret that Villeneuve had been a high-ranking member of the old government of which he spoke, though he was pretty certain the ambassador couldn't know just how at the center of things he'd truly been.
I work now, Villeneuve continued, to build a new future for my people, and to wash away the guilt and pain I bear for my participation in the old government. I fear I wasn't in a position to change the Union's ways, yet I was also too weak to take a stand by resigning my posts. I shall take that shame to my grave.
He cast his eyes down as he spoke, impressing himself with the intensity of his false remorse. Villeneuve watched as the ambassador's expression softened. He felt a rush of satisfaction. It never ceased to amaze him the degree to which people could convince themselves to believe what they wanted to believe. The collective had long lived in fear of its larger neighbor. The thought of a friendly relationship was a seductive one, and clearly the ambassador had allowed that to cloud his judgment.
We're very pleased at the prospect of improved relations, Citizen Villeneuve. I congratulate you and your people on the steps you have taken. You are to be praised. The unrest in your nation could have led in a much darker direction.
Indeed it could have, Mr. Ambassador. I can only hope that our continued efforts will keep us on the path to peace and prosperity for our billions of workers and for our neighbors and friends.
We of the collective certainly share that hope with you, Citizen Villeneuve, and I can state our sincere and fervent hope that our future is one of friendship.
Villeneuve smiled and nodded. A few seconds later, he allowed his expression to shift one of concern.
There are many challenges ahead of us, I feel.
Challenges?
Yes, Ambassador. It's a travesty that past Union governments have behaved badly towards the collective and the other nations on the periphery. We all face the same threat, after all. We should have been natural allies rather than Cold War adversaries.
Villeneuve didn't mention the fact that the Union's Cold War on its frontier neighbors had gone hot several times, resulting in more than 24 systems being annexed over the past 20 years.
What threat do we share, Citizen Villeneuve? Without any intent to offend, I must state that we have long considered the Union itself to be the greatest danger to our sovereignty.
That's understandable, Ambassador. As I've said, the actions of the government of the old Union were indefensible. Yet I fear the irrational concern Union actions may have caused your nation helped to hide the true danger posed not by us, certainly not now at least, but by the Confederation.
The Confederation?
The ambassador seemed surprised at Villeneuve's words.
Of course, Ambassador. Even in the dark years, when the Union was perceived as a menace to you, it also insulated you from the Confederation's expansion. They are a nation that exports propaganda, stories of prosperity and peaceful intentions, but the reality is quite different. Their prosperity is built on their utter disregard for their workforces. Billions of workers toil in unsafe factories, living in abject poverty as their laborers help to build the vast wealth of the industrial princes and the oligarchical families that rule through the sham of their Senate.
We have limited contact with the Confederation. They are far from us, and the Union lies astride almost every route to their space. We have never considered them a threat.
For the very reasons you just stated, Ambassador, because the Union always lay between you and them. But it's no secret that the Union has been weakened, that we are more vulnerable to Confederation aggressions than ever in our history. And if the People's Union is conquered by the Confederation, how long do you think the Collective and the other periphery nations would remain independent? If we are defeated, your fates will be sealed. You will all fall under Confederation control sooner or later.
The ambassador looked back, a puzzled look on his face. Villeneuve knew he wouldn't bring the Collective or any of the other periphery nations over to his side immediately. There was too much history of Union aggression.
but he was sure he'd get there. He could feel movement even now, doubts in the ambassador's mind that hadn't been there moments before. He had time, some at least, but when the moment came for the next phase of the struggle, he intended to have the entire periphery behind him. And with any luck, they would face a confederation riven by internal dissension. The Union had always relied on brute force against the Confeds, but now it was time for finesse. Time to end this century-long conflict once and for all. Villeneuve read the report for the second time. Lié had been aggressive from the instant he'd arrived on Danith. Very aggressive. He'd grabbed a suspected Confederation operative, one he seemed to believe he had a chance to subvert. Villeneuve wasn't so sure about that, but Lié was no fool. If he couldn't entice the captured agent to support Sector 9. The People's Protectorate, you fool, you have to remember that. If he couldn't get the agent to switch allegiances, he'd still get useful information out of her. And no one matched Ricard Lié's ability to dispose of an asset that had no further value. He reached over and tapped a few keys on his keyboard, bringing up another highly classified report. His intel from inside the Confederation was spotty and only partially reliable. His resources were fewer than they'd been in the days of Sector 9, and he developed almost all of what he did to have Lié's and Marielis's operations. But the report seemed reliable, and it concerned him greatly. There was a naval task force in Danith's system, far larger and more powerful than anything he'd expected to be there, especially since the post-war demobilizations. The Confeds had decommissioned dozens of ships since the war ended, just as he'd suspected they would, as he'd counted on them doing. The peace party in the Confederation was strong and energetic even without his assistance, and despite his own troubles, he'd managed to continue to exert influence in the Senate. It was difficult to bully or entice senators to undertake actions viewed as disloyal or treasonous, but it was relatively easy to encourage them to be more aggressive about things they wanted to do anyway. The Confederation Navy's budget had been slashed on three separate occasions, and it was now barely 80% of what it had been before the war. Thousands of veteran spacers had been retired on half pensions, and the return to the civilian workforce, coupled with the millions of workers laid off as military production fell from a breakneck pace to almost nothing, had impacted planetary economies throughout the Confederation. The Confeds didn't face an economic depression anywhere near as severe as the one he was still struggling to overcome in the Union, but Confed citizens weren't as used to deprivation either, and there had been unrest on a number of worlds. That all played into his hands perfectly, making it easier for his creatures in the Senate to push for yet more diversion of funds from the military budgets to social programs and civil spending designed to boost the economy and quell the angry population. Villeneuve had spent the year after the ceasefire concerned that the Confeds would reinstate hostilities. Though he knew the Confederation well enough that he wasn't surprised at their willingness to stop the war as they had, he was still relieved when the ceasefire turned into a treaty, and the Confed forces pulled back into their own space. Tactically, it had been a huge mistake, and in terms of long-term strategy, it was even more foolish. The Confeds had thrown away a chance to establish a level of dominance that would have eliminated the prospect of future wars. They could have made themselves almost invulnerable, but instead they had given him a chance to salvage the Union, to rebuild its strength and continue to scheme, and to prepare for a day when he could seek vengeance for what he knew perfectly well had been a defeat, however much his propaganda specialists might call it a draw that the Union had accepted to achieve peace. Now his concerns of renewed war before he could have the Union ready had faded away. The greatly reduced Confed Navy was still stronger than his battered forces, but not by enough of a margin to mount a credible invasion threat. And the Alliance, now allied with the Confederation, had seen its own forces devastated, first by civil war, then in combat at the bottleneck, and finally in their vengeance-driven conflict with the Krillians. In the long term, the Alliance, bolstered by the annexation of the Krillian systems, would be more powerful than ever. But for the immediate future, they had significant rebuilding to do before they could project meaningful offensive power far beyond their own borders. He had time, but not an unlimited amount of it. He had to make things happen before his adversaries became too powerful to match. A league between the Union and the nations of the periphery would help. If he could bring the collective in, he was sure the others would eventually follow. The entities on the edge of human habitation were small and weak by the standards of nations like the Union and the Confederation, but combined together they would be a significant factor in any future conflict. Still, that wouldn't be enough. League forces might just offset the alliance, but there was little chance of the Union regaining its advantage over the Confeds. He had to do everything possible to weaken the Confederation, even to destabilize it. It had been months since he'd sent Mariellis to Megara, and the reports he'd received suggested she had made some progress expanding on the influence he'd established in the Senate. But her mission was a colossal one, and he knew he'd have to give her all the support he could if she was to have any real chance of pulling it off. Perhaps Denith is a start on that. The fleet concentration in the system was out of the ordinary, and Villeneuve doubted the Confederation Senate knew what was going on there. Most likely it was Confederation intelligence, possibly overstepping their authority, and very likely trying to keep it as quiet as so massive an operation could be. It seemed odd to him, coming as he did from a system where the intel agencies had almost free rein, but the Confeds didn't operate that way. Gary Holston had been continually hampered by senatorial oversight and other restrictions that had handicapped his agency's efforts to match Sector 9. It was an unavoidable aspect of Republican government, one he fortunately didn't have to deal with in his own operations. Still, it told him Holston must have a good reason for taking such a risk.
They must be onto Ricard.
That greatly increased the danger his friend faced. Lié was a survivor, but if Confederation intelligence had sent an entire naval task force to the system, it didn't bode well for Lié getting very far in his mission. He'd been spending most of his time avoiding capture and trying to preserve his operation from Confed attempts to crush it. That would interfere with expanded efforts to locate old tech artifacts.
But maybe we can still gain an edge from this.
His fingers moved across the keyboard, pulling up a blank screen and then typing a set of new orders. Orders for Desiree Mariellis. Villeneuve understood the Confeds. He'd spent his entire adult life trying to devise ways to defeat them. Whoever sent a naval task force to Danith had to be highly ranked, probably Gary Holston himself. If it was Holston, he'd pushed his authority to the absolute limits. The Confederation intelligence head had stuck his neck out on this one, and Villeneuve was more than ready to chop it off if he could. He finished typing the orders, and then he hit the send button. His system was highly secure, and no one but his personal AI would see what he'd written. The computer would encrypt the message and see that it was sent to Mariellis, looking very much like normal diplomatic comm traffic or personal correspondence. Anything but what it was, instructions to see that the right senators found out about the naval concentration at Danith, and that they responded as he knew they would. Holston had been a worthy opponent over the years, especially considering the difficulties he'd had to bear working in the Confederation system. But now he'd made a rare mistake. He'd exposed himself. And Gaston Villeneuve had every intention of taking advantage of that fact to destroy his rival. Chapter 21. CFS Repulse. Z-11 System. Year 315 AC.
Commodore!
The officer's voice was shrill, uncontrolled, not at all what Sarah Eaton had come to expect from her crew. What is it, Lieutenant? Eaton's voice was hard, expressing her displeasure with a lack of discipline in the officer's voice without actually saying anything about it.
Commodore, General Rogan reports the landing party is encountered.
The officer paused.
Encountered what?
Eaton was getting very impatient.
People, Commodore. They found people.
Eden was taken aback by the report, her mind raced to accept what she'd just been told. She'd been ready to find every manner of artifact, even some still active and attacking her people, but encountering live humans.
Put General Rogan on my line, Lieutenant, immediately.
Yes, Commodore.
A short pause.
The General is coming, sir. He stepped away from the comm station for a moment.
A few seconds passed then. Commodore? It was Rogan, and as soon as she heard his tone, he knew something significant had happened.
What's going on down there, Brian?
We found live survivors. It was a matter-of-fact statement, but it hit her like a hammer.
Survivors of what? Some forgotten expedition? Have we actually encountered some smuggler traffic up this far?
Negative, Commodore. They appear to be actual survivors of the cataclysm. A short pause. Or at least their descendants.
Eden just sat in her chair, silent for a moment, trying to accept what the Marine officer had told her.
She'd probably have written the words off to space fever or delusions if they'd come from almost anyone else. But Brian Rogan was the coolest, most controlled person she'd ever met.
Are you sure, Brian? It was a stupid question, and she realized that the instant it escaped her lips. It was hard to believe they'd found people living out this far, but unless the entire landing party was suffering from hallucinations, there didn't seem to be any doubt.
Yes, Commodore, there's no question. The general paused. They're different. We're trying to communicate, but we can't understand them. And it doesn't seem they know what we're saying either.
Another hesitation. And they're... She could tell Rogan was struggling for words.
Altered.
Altered? She wasn't sure what he was trying to say.
They seem to have a variety of physical... defects. Many of them seem unable to stand completely upright, and others seem to have partially withered arms or legs or strange lesions on their faces or extremities.
Could they be injured? Crash victims, perhaps?
That was my first thought, too, but I don't think so, Commodore. It seems almost like they're suffering from mutations of some kind, possibly from the atomic bombardments that obviously occurred here, and maybe also from chemical or biological agents used. They also appear to be members of a primitive culture of some sort.
Eden leaned back in her chair, trying to understand the implications of Rogan's statement. She knew that some of the outer worlds, planets and systems now part of the Confederation or one of the other powers, had fallen into primitive barbarism of a sort after the Cataclysm. Some planets had lost more technology than others, barely hanging on to basic civilization. It was the retention of a significant knowledge base that gave worlds like Megara and Montmorel an advantage over their neighbors and led to the formation of the Confederation and the Union. But she'd never heard of a civilization fallen as low as the one Rogan seemed to be describing.
Do the best you can to try to establish some kind of communication, Brian. I'm sending down another wave of landing parties. I'll get you every expert we've got, and we'll go from there.
Very well, Commodore. We'll do our best down here.
Good luck, Brian.
Eden cut the line, and then she turned toward the comm station. Before she did anything, she had to report this to Admiral Barron.
Get me Dauntless, now.
Rogan walked back toward the front of the group facing the... He wasn't sure if natives was the right word, though he no longer doubted the people standing and watching the landing parties had been born on this world. His own people were mostly quiet, staring back in stunned shock, but the Marines had their weapons out and at the ready. He almost ordered them to sling their rifles, but he was a Marine himself, and he couldn't help but think of the visitors as a potential threat. They didn't look terribly dangerous. In fact, when he got back from the compost, they were laying prostrate in front of his people, almost as though they were kneeling, or paying homage of some kind. He almost told them to get up, but they wouldn't understand his words anyway. He turned and looked back behind him toward the shuttles and the stunned crowd of Marines and scientists.
"Where the hell is that thing?"
"Coming, sir." The answer came from behind the crowd, and few seconds later three Marines came running forward carrying a large piece of equipment. It looked a bit like a portable workstation, but Rogan knew it was the mobile translation AI he'd ordered his people to retrieve.
"Sorry, General, we had a tough time finding it. For a minute I thought it got left behind."
Rogan wouldn't have been surprised. The shuttles had been stripped of most of their normal gear to make room for weapons and scanning equipment. The last thing anyone had expected was the need to translate between different tongues so deep in the long-dead empire. It was just dumb luck one of the units had remained aboard a shuttle and not gotten pulled out and thrown on the deck of a launch bay. It was still a long shot at best anyway. He doubted it would be of any help. It was only programmed with known languages, and it was clear to Rogan that whoever these people were, they hadn't come from the Confederation or anywhere near it.
"Get that set up as quickly as possible."
He turned back toward the visitors, looking at them intently, panning his eyes across the group. There were 10 of them, and everyone was down on his or her hands and knees. Rogan wondered if it could be some kind of normal greeting, but it seemed very degrading for that. They almost looked like worshippers lying prostrate before a deity. There were small piles in front of each of them. At first, Rogan couldn't tell what they were, but now he realized they were polished stones and similar trinkets. Gifts? Perhaps a way to greet visitors?
But how would they have ever had visitors?
It didn't make sense. Even if some small vestige of a civilization had survived on this world, bereft of the technology their ancestors had once possessed, it didn't explain their apparent lack of astonishment at people landing on their planet in spaceships. They were respectful, even obsequious, but they didn't seem surprised. Almost as if having visitors is a common occurrence. Barron looked intently at the natives closest to him. They wore strange clothing, old and worn and very simple, but clearly some type of manufacture and not the kinds of skins or simple garments a truly primitive culture might wear. The men and women seemed to be dressed identically, each of them wearing a pair of brown pants and a tunic that looked like a cross between a shirt and a jacket. They were all filthy, their clothes torn in places and covered in some kind of thick gray dust. Rogan wished he had a cultural expert with him, but the landing party had been assembled to examine ancient technology, not some kind of civilization. He wondered if the fleet even had a decent cadre of anthropologists and language experts among its complement. He suspected if such personnel were there, Commodore Eaton and Admiral Barron were looking for them now.
The AI is set up, General.
The lieutenant was standing next to the apparatus, looking at it like he was far from certain he'd know whether it was ready or not. But the landing party had its share of electronics and computer experts, and Rogan could see several of them nodding.
Just bring this unit with you, General, one of the engineers said. He handed Rogan a small device that looked like a microphone.
After the general took it, the engineer gave him a headset. The unit will translate anything picked up by the microphone and relay it to your headset, assuming, of course, it is identifiable. The AI will estimate if it cannot positively identify any language, and it will provide a projected percentage chance of accuracy. The engineer paused. Once the unit has gained some data on the language in use, it will be able to convert your own speech as well. Rogan just nodded. He'd led desperate assaults and faced almost certain death more than once, but this was a situation he'd never imagined. One all his years of training and experience had done nothing to prepare him to handle. He walked toward the closest native, slowly, not wanting to appear threatening. He knelt down slowly, edged closer, and he reached out and touched the man's shoulder. The native jumped up and back from Rogan, shouting a series of words the Marine didn't understand. No, Rogan thought, not shouting. The man's tone was respectful, almost reverential.
The subject is professing his loyalty to you, General.
The AI's voice was loud in the headset. Perhaps more than loyalty, the tongue appears to be a variant of the ancient imperial language, though the version in use by the subject is severely degraded. It is too early to make definitive assumptions, but the choice of words suggests a sharply limited vocabulary. Preliminary analysis indicates findings consistent with an ex-imperial culture that has regressed considerably. That made perfect sense to Rogan. It was clear the people standing in front of his Marines had fallen considerably in technology and knowledge, and they had to be the descendants of survivors of the cataclysm. Where else could they have come from?
Can you translate into their dialect?
Yes, the AI responded. Partially, at least. I do not have a sufficient pool of colloquialisms nor a firm idea of the limitation on vocabulary, but I do have a full database of all known variants of imperial languages.
Translate what I say.
Rogan took a deep breath. He hated being the point man in this contact. He felt out of his depth and far from his area of expertise. But the natives were there, right in front of his people. He couldn't exactly tell them to wait until Eaton got another wave of shuttles to the surface. And he was in command on the planet. If they even understand what a shuttle is.
Yes, General.
Rogan looked toward the man closest to him. He had no real idea, but his gut told him that was the leader.
We have come in peace. We mean you no harm.
Rogan paused as the AI's emotionless voice broadcast from the unit speakers. He could make out some of what it was saying. The prime tongue used throughout most of the rim was also based on ancient imperial, though it had evolved and changed considerably over the centuries. Still, many words were the same, or at least similar. The man looked confused at first, his eyes darting around, trying to identify the source of what he was hearing. Finally, he turned toward Rogan, his head still downcast, and he spoke. Rogan tried to follow what the man was saying, and he managed to pick up a few words, but the guttural nature of the speech made it difficult to pick out even recognizable words. Before he could make anything of it, the AI's voice filled his headset. I have been able to translate a portion of the subject's speech. The grammar and structure differ considerably from any imperial norms in my database, but I was able to identify a sufficient sampling to decipher basic meanings. The response was almost certainly a greeting, though not one between equals. The subject is speaking to you as though you are a higher being.
You mean a superior rank?
No, not precisely. A better, a superior being, not a deity, but something on that order. One term that has been repeated translates as higher one or master.
Master, as in master and slave?
Slavery wasn't an unknown concept among the Rimward nations, but no world in the Confederation had seen it for a century or more. There is a level of analytical speculation required to answer your question. I do not perceive a representation of literal ownership as much as a term of grave respect. There are definite indications of fear in the subject's voice.
Respect, like a peasant-lord relationship?
I do not believe your comparison is entirely accurate. There is a 94% probability that the subject considers himself an inferior being to you and the other members of the landing party. However, no indication has been given as to the source of such an assertion. It is possible the being's deference is simply the result of seeing the technology on display, but I also detect signs of familiarity and ritual in the speech and actions of the natives.
Rogan was really uncomfortable now. His entire life had been one subject to the rigidity of rank, and he'd seen his share of such things from both the bottom and the top. But that wasn't what the AI was describing. The Confederation was a republic, and in theory, at least, its people were equal. There were other cultures, of course, with such hierarchies imposed by law. He didn't have to look any farther than his alliance allies to find an inflexible caste system enforcing institutional inequality. But again, that wasn't what the AI was telling him. Not exactly.
Are you saying this person considers us gods?
Your terminology is too broad to acknowledge without qualifiers, yet you are close to the truth here. These people apparently consider you and the others to be higher order beings of some kind. They regard you with a combination of awe and fear.
Rogan sighed, unsure how to proceed. He'd signed on to the mission, fully prepared to do his duty, to defend the members of the expedition from any dangerous old tech that might be active enough to cause a threat. But he'd never imagined finding survivors, and certainly not having them crawl before him as though he were some kind of god. He glanced down at his chronometer. It would be at least another 30 minutes before the new wave of shuttles landed, and he wondered how his visitors would react to watching a whole fleet of ships blasting their way down. Would they run in terror? Or would it just reaffirm their belief that he and the others from the fleet were gods come down to them from the heavens? Shit, he muttered softly, hoping the AI didn't pick it up and translate it. I didn't sign up for this.
Chapter 22. CFS Repulse. Z-11 System. Year 315 AC. Rogan walked through the sparse woods, following the group of natives. He'd managed to communicate to a certain extent, and while he was talking, he noticed the difference in the men and women who appeared to call the planet home. They were humans, of course, that much was clear, though they were different from his own people, and not just in language and knowledge. Most of them displayed physical variations beyond those typical of human beings. Some were completely hairless, others seemed to have misshapen limbs. A few appeared to have larger-than-normal heads or protruding foreheads. Most of them seemed weaker than normal humans as well, and they moved slowly as they led the landing party to wherever they were going. So slowly he'd had to tell his people to slow down half a dozen times so as not to overtake their hosts. Rogan had no idea where they were being taken. He'd breathed a sigh of relief when the second wave of shuttles finally landed, and every expert or semi-expert Sarah Eaton could find debarked and relieved him from his unwanted duties as primary ambassador to the residents of the planet. He gratefully fell back from the forefront of the exchanges and focused on organizing his Marines into security details to accompany the landing teams. The natives didn't seem particularly threatening, but he wasn't one to take chances. And whatever was going on, it was certainly strange enough to warrant caution. The natives did view his people as something close to gods. He'd managed to verify that much. From what the linguistics AI and the newly arrived experts had told him, they were being taken to a place where some kind of offering awaited them. That word gave him the willies. He didn't know what it meant, other than something beyond the polished stones they'd been given earlier. But the whole situation was just too strange and unexpected for his tastes. Thoughts of all sorts of things drifted into his mind. Baskets of grain, butchered animals, even human sacrifice. Anything seemed possible. The group followed a rough path through the woods. They were moving south, away from the ruins of the great city. That, at least, was good news. Admiral Barron would want the city explored, almost certainly, but the radiation readings were quite high, even from almost 10 kilometers distance, and any team planning to move closer or to explore the ruins themselves would need heavy protective gear. It would take time to shuttle down the equipment required, along with another group of experts to carry out the exploration.
Meanwhile, everyone in the landing party had strict orders not to approach the dead city.
You assume it's dead, but we thought the whole planet was dead.
Still, the radiation readings suggested nothing human, at least.